Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Daniel Jenka. He works with Energy Concepts Corporation in Las Vegas, New Mexico, which designs and installs solar and wind-powered systems. He teaches renewable energy classes at Luna Community College and gives workshops on renewable energy throughout the state. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you. So let's talk about a couple of words that we hear a lot, renewable and sustainable. Uh-huh. They're not really exactly the same thing.
They're not quite the same meaning. Renewable is really more of a technical description, meaning that if an energy source is self-replenishing, for example, or can be used indefinitely with a certain rate of use, then that's renewable. But sustainable includes more than that. It also includes social aspects having to do with the equality of driving that energy and things that are, let's say, beyond technical.
An interesting example is biomass, which a lot of us have heard of. Biomass is a renewable resource. You grow things, you turn them into energy, you grow them back. In theory, they could be carbon neutral, but the reality is if you want to use it on a mass scale, you'd have to stop eating.
That's right.
Or cut your population down. You know, you'd have to decimate the population of the
Earth. It's not socially sustainable,
right,
is the problem. That's right.
So let's talk first about solar. There's different kinds of solar energy that can be used to do various things. And I think I mentioned this the other day, but I was talking to a friend who lived in the East Coast in a pretty cold climate and did not know that there was such a thing as panels that heated water. He thought that the only solar panels were photovoltaic panels that made electricity. That's a distinction that needs to be made.
It is, and people often don't know what that distinction is. So, you know, in workshops or when I take calls, people will often just say, hi, I'm interested in solar, or what can you tell me about solar? And so my question is, what do you mean by solar?
Right.
So, yeah, there are these two categories. The most basic one is simply to take solar radiation and use it for heat. And everyone knows that if the sun strikes something, it gets hot, like a brick laying in the street.
Or your
car, or you, for that matter.
Right.
So that's solar thermal.
And solar thermal can be used by making a house that has lots of windows, and they come in and they heat your floor, which holds the heat of the floor.
That's right. That's a passive solar way of heating a house. Passive meaning that there are no mechanisms involved. There's no motors, pumps, or other things. It's just the design of the house that allows solar radiation, sunlight, let's call it, to come in through windows and to heat thermal mass inside that house, which would be like, you know, tile and cement floors and so on and so forth. And they store the heat, and then in the evening when the house starts to cool, the heat just naturally radiates out of those things. So that's a passive solar design.
And when you use solar that comes out of solar panels, mm-hmm. you use the sunlight to heat hot water in panels. How does that work?
Well, water happens to be one of the best ways to absorb solar radiation and turn it into heat. It has a very high capacity of heat storage. So what you're doing basically is you're pumping a fluid, which is mostly water, mixed with a bit of non-toxic antifreeze, so it doesn't freeze at night in places like Santa Fe where it could freeze at night. But the water goes through this glass-covered panel. It absorbs all of that that heat, and then it can be transferred to other places like heating hot water for your showers and whatnot, which we call domestic hot water, or it could go through a radiant floor and heat your living space. So, but in both of those cases, those are active systems because there's a pump involved typically.
Right. How cold a climate can you use that kind of a system in?
Well, it depends not so much on how cold the climate is. It has a lot to do with weather and how much sunlight you get. So some cold climates get a lot of sun, like central Canada, for example. They have a lot of sunshine in the winter. So a lot of potential. But if you go to coastal areas, you might have a lot of cloudy days. Or I'm from Michigan, for example, which is surrounded by the Great Lakes, which are the great cloud makers.
Right.
So so it's not how cold it is. It's how much sunlight you have and how intense it is. But
so if it's 35 degrees and cloudy for a week, you're going to get less solar hot water than if it's 1 degree and sunny for a week.
That's right.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's true because it would take some calculating. But basically, for solar hot water systems to work, you need to have a preponderance of sunny days in the winter for the winter part of it to work. But if you're using solar to heat hot water all year, let's say to make hot water for your showers and whatnot, that's a 12-month scenario. And so even in some climates that are far north, they might have 5 or 6 months of very good sunny weather, and they might have 5 or 6 months of not so sunny weather, but it could still make sense. What it really comes down to is it depends on what kind of a heating source you're replacing with solar and how expensive it is and how environmentally damaging it is. That's part of the equation.
So when people are talking about, and we'll get to this in more detail in a moment, but when people are talking about putting something in their house, however much we might want to be green and do our part in reducing our solar footprint, the economic calculation is a big part of it.
It always is. That's right, because there's always an expense involved with any kind of equipment and installing it. And again, it depends on a number of factors. Speaking locally here, let's say in Santa Fe and the area around Santa Fe County, if you're looking at solar thermal, typically you're looking to replace one of three different energy sources. One could be electric. You may be using electricity, for example, to make hot water, or maybe even to heat your house in some cases. You may be using natural gas to make hot water or to heat your house. You know, or you may also be using propane to make hot water and heat your house.
Right.
Sometimes all three
right.
in the same house. So what you have to do to figure it out is you have to look at the cost of all of those energy sources and then look at the cost of a solar heating system after tax credits and whatnot. And then you can do the apples to oranges comparison and figure out, hey, is this a good investment? Does it make sense?
Let's talk now about photovoltaic. What that term means is converting sunlight into electricity. How does that work?
Yeah, it's literally turning photons into voltage, photovoltaic. Well, the way it typically works is wafers of silicon are grown and then treated in a special way and put into kind of a sandwich of two layers.
So silicon is basically beach sand.
Silica, it's sand.
Yeah,
just sand. It's very plentiful, so we're not running out of sand.
Right.
Anyway, so there's two layers of silica crystals are grown, actually using the same methods as are used to make chips and computers. But
right.
but these are large, so they're grown and they're put together into a like a sandwich. In the middle of that sandwich, as the cheese, let's say, is our electrical conducting materials. And the two layers are actually treated, it's called doping, so that one of them has an excess of electrons and one has a shortage of electrons. And what happens is when sunlight, when photons strike the surface, it causes a rise in potential and electrons flow. It basically makes them flow. And so that's how those systems work. And so all those little cells are put together in large numbers, and those are what we call modules, which is what most people call panels, the big rectangular things. That's a solar module or panel.
So how much has that technology changed and improved? I mean, that technology has been around for a while.
It's been around, at least since the 60s, a long time. Well, the conventional technology is to use these silicon cells. And that technology has been evolving steadily for 30 or more years, which is about how long it's been involved in making solar panels for rooftops for homes and whatnot. And so the evolution really centers around a couple of things. One is increasing the efficiency. And efficiency with solar, with photovoltaics, simply means that you increase the amount of power of electricity that you can produce with a given area, say like a square meter or a square foot. So a higher efficiency means that same area produces more power. So that's one of the areas where these conventional, what are called first generation PV technologies have improved over the years.
So it may be that the amount of power you could get out of a 6 by 6 foot solar panel, now you can get that out of a 2 by 2 foot panel.
Something like that. That's right. That's right. Right. And there's a theoretical limit with crystals made from silicon. It's actually about 30% is the maximum theoretical limit. Just the physics of it. And right now, a typical PV module is maybe around 17 or 18%.
So we're getting there, but
we're kind of getting there. And of course, the closer you get to the limit, it's like Zeno with the wall. You know, you never actually quite get there because the expense goes up. But they're evolving, and they've also improved in terms of the amount of energy it takes to make them, which is very important because that's related to the environmental impact and the cost. So the cost has come down, the energy use has come down, the efficiency has gone up. And the life cycle of them has increased because of just improvements in the materials.
Are there any changes or innovations in the materials you use? Does it have to be silica?
No, there are other technologies out there that use various kinds of metals and what are called amorphous thin films and so on and so forth. In fact, we're into what's now the third generation of PV, which is utilizing things like nanotechnology. And the hope there is that we can make solar panels that cost less per unit of power out. Because that's actually more important than efficiency. What you really want to know is for how little can you get how much?
Right. Now, are the factories that make solar panels powered by solar panels?
A little bit, not actually, not even mostly, because it takes a lot of energy to make solar panels. In fact, there's something that's called the embodied energy, which you can also think of as energy payback with solar panels, which is if you take all the energy used to manufacture them, how long would it take?
All the coal or nuclear, say, or whatever.
Oh, those are terrible if you actually
But in other words, you're using some non-renewable resource.
That's exactly right.
To make this renewable energy source.
That's exactly right. And whatever, it could be hydropower, nuclear, coal, natural gas. You know, it's a mix depending on where you are in the world. But anyway, recent studies have shown that it takes, for panels that are used, let's say, in an environment like here in New Mexico, there's a study done looking at modules in Portugal, which is a similar environment. It takes 1 to 2 years of energy made by a solar panel to equal the energy that went into making it. So that's about where we're at.
So that's interesting. So let's say that I'm heating my house with electricity that is coming from the coal and nuclear generating plants in the state of New Mexico or in the Southwest or whatever. It takes 1 year to use the same amount to generate solar electricity from my panels equal to the amount that was used to make them.
That's right. And solar thermal panels are similar. It depends on where the panel is. If you're someplace that has a lot of sun like we do, then the payback time is faster. That's right.
But so basically after a year or two, then you are in the positive and you're actually doing something good for the carbon footprint of the planet.
That's exactly right. And all of these, solar thermal and electric, they have 25, 30-year lifespans.
Right.
So they produce...
So you're doing some good.
You're doing a lot of good. Multiples.
Right.
Many multiples of good.
We're talking to Daniel Jenka, who is with the company called Energy Concepts. So, let's see. Could you, in theory, by using photovoltaic panels and by using solar hot water heating panels on the roof of every house in New Mexico, get every house in New Mexico not to use any energy from other sources?
Well, not quite. Although you could put a huge dent in our use of coal, for example, in nuclear. One of the challenges with large-scale solar with electric, let's say, whether it's being produced on individual rooftops or with big, you know, solar farms put up by utilities, is that the sun is making energy in a 5 or 6 hour period in the middle of the day, but we use our energy 24 hours a day. So there's the problem of storage. And right now we don't have a way to store large amounts of electricity or heat for that matter, so that it can be used all day long. So a lot of experts feel that without storage, our limit may be like 10 or 20%.
Now, hang on. It seems like with water, it would be a whole lot easier. You heat your water, you put it in an insulated tank. If the tank's big enough, you've got enough hot water for the whole day. The sun comes out again tomorrow. You're
in
business.
It is. With individual, like homes and businesses, yeah, actually, hot water does very well. If you're looking at space heating, a system will typically offset 2/3 to 3/4 of all your heating needs. You can't do all of it because there are days when the sun's not out. We can get 2 or 3 days in a row, and it's hard to store heat for that long. So it's still a very high percentage. And for just hot water for showers and baths and whatnot, those systems provide 90 or 95% because they work all year long.
Right.
And so...
Now, energy storage is something that is really a weak link in the whole system when you talk about using solar for everything, both on a large scale, which we'll also talk about in a minute, and a residential scale. Is that something where there's a lot of research and development going on to try to find new and better ways to store energy?
Yeah, there is research going on, and the particular technology depends on the scale of it, really. For example, for large-scale storage, people are looking at things like compressed air in deep caverns, where you could have wind turbines and solar drive compressors all day long and basically compress air. And then later on, maybe you could use the compressed air to drive an air turbine and make electricity.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So there's possibilities with that. For small-scale systems that individuals would put in, it turns out that being tied into the grid, here talking about electricity, is actually pretty green because the grid is already there. And so if we get 10% of households, let's say in businesses, producing solar and just shooting it out in the grid, really they've become a solar utility, and they're handling as much solar generated power as there's a use for, minus storage. Now, if we had a really cost-effective, sustainable battery of some kind that we could put into our homes and businesses and produce excess electricity and then use it 24 hours a day, that'd be very good. There are some things that are potentially there. There are things called ultracapacitors, which is a kind of a next-generation battery, and that might be a solution. Some people look towards like hydrogen fuel cells, which are actually a way to store energy, not to make it.
Right.
And they might work.
Well, storage is the question.
It's a big question for the future. Yeah, to really scale this whole thing up, we do need storage.
So what are the non-renewable resources besides energy that are used in making solar panels?
Well, you have aluminum. And other metals. The frames are typically made out of aluminum. That's actually one of the biggest energy users is the metal that goes into the frames for the kinds of panels that are surrounded that
Just
way.
Just the frames?
Yeah, that's right, the frames. There's also insulation that goes in the backs of, say, solar thermal panels. And, of course, there's glass over the tops of both PV and solar thermal panels. Of course, glass is made from silica, but it takes energy to make glass, too. So.
And what's the... But glass is, in theory, abundant. It's not like something you have to mine.
And recyclable.
And recyclable, as is aluminum.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
If only we would do it.
That's right.
What is the material inside of the sandwich of the solar panel?
Well, aside from the silica, it's actually just some metals, including some rare metals in very small quantities.
So those also factor into the equation.
They do, that's right, although they're a very, very small factor in terms of the energy. It's mostly the silica and melting it and growing the cells and making the glass and making the metal frames.
So So here we are in New Mexico, and we have the question of when a solar system, like a photovoltaic system, is going to pay for itself, or a solar hot water heating system is going to pay for itself in terms of carbon footprint. We also have a question of when it's going to pay for itself economically.
That's right. Well, again, all kinds of factors. And to figure this out, you need to separate solar thermal from photovoltaic. So let's just look at solar thermal first. You know, heating with the sun means that you're trying to replace another energy source, like I said earlier. If you're replacing an expensive energy source, like propane or electricity, then that means that your investment will pay for itself sooner because you're saving more money every day and every month and every year. Here in Santa Fe, most of the homes are natural gas, which is substantially less expensive than electricity or propane. But basically, and with most analyses, if you're looking at, say, like a solar hot water heater that's just for making domestic hot water, if you're offsetting propane, it's probably like a electric. It's like a 7 or 8 year payback typically. If you're offsetting natural gas, it may be something like a 11 or 12 year payback. But that's taking into account tax credits. And for both solar thermal and photovoltaic, we have 30% federal tax credits and 10% state tax credits, and there's no gross receipts tax. So basically, you're getting rid of 40% of the cost of putting these systems in. And without those tax credits, you could not make economic sense
out of this. It'd be way too long of a payback time.
That's right, and that's why they're important, because if we're going to grow this industry, it has to make economic sense, and those credits help to do that. On the photovoltaic side, there's a little bit of added factoring going in. The tax credits are there again. But now, for example, with PNM, with electricity, there are two things that go into the payback. One of them is through what's called net metering. What that means is that every kilowatt hour of electricity you make is one you don't buy. So that's just avoided cost.
Right.
But the other one is a renewable energy credits. And utilities like PNM will actually pay their customers 13 cents a kilowatt hour, or 15 for business customers, for every kilowatt hour they produced with their PV system, even though they used it. And so that's...
So the PNM will pay me for the electricity that I used?
That you made and used.
That I made and used.
That's right. So
it's like I make a pie and eat it and someone pays me for that?
Basically, but they want to take credit for the piece of the pie that you made, because they're mandated by the Public Regulation Commission to reach these renewable energy targets.
Right.
And so they get to, by paying you per kilowatt hour, they get to claim it as part of their total renewable energy in their grid. And that's why they do it.
Oh, okay. So basically, I see. So the humans who are doing this are putting in all the capital expenditure, and then they're claiming that. They don't have to build anything. They just sit there and they
avoid the upfront cost.
They avoid any capital costs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Now, it's possible in theory that if everybody did this, if the incentives were strong enough, and one of the very interesting things that came out of the legislature was that people will be able to, if they install a photovoltaic system, pay for it incrementally on their property tax bill.
That's right.
And so if that's the case, there's a real, a lot of people don't have 20 grand to spare, but they can add an extra $500, twice a year on their property tax.
That's right.
If that catches on, what's to keep PNM from almost going out of business? They'll have to generate the energy that we use at night to keep our refrigerator on and our TV when we're watching Jon Stewart. And that's about
Well, what PNM does is every time an existing customer of theirs, well, it could be a new customer for new construction, but anytime a customer of theirs has a photovoltaic system that's what we call tied into the grid, they sign an individual contract with you, and I think they're 10 or 11 year contracts. at some point, if we had so many people tied into the grid that they couldn't use that electricity at that time of day, I imagine they would stop writing those contracts. But we're a long ways from that. But there would come a point without storage where they couldn't. We'd literally have too much electricity at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right. More is going into the grid than is coming out.
That people are using. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that hasn't happened yet. But if it happened, it would be a good problem, not necessarily for them, but certainly for society.
It'd be a great problem to have. Yeah, too much clean energy would be great.
We're talking to Daniel Jenka of Energy Concepts, a company in Las Vegas that designs and installs solar and wind power systems. So there's tax incentives. There's the public regulation has mandated PNM to do all of this. How far are we from being able to actually replace coal and nuclear? And where would that replacement come from if it came from solar? If you had everybody putting solar panels all over their houses and businesses doing that and colleges and institutions and hospitals doing that and everything, how far along would we be? Or would you still need some kind of big old planes that had windmills and solar panels on them that centrally generated huge amounts of electricity?
Well, you know, it's kind of a developing, it's a developing technology, and the solutions are kind of developing as things go along. But generally speaking, to produce large quantities, gigawatts of electricity, the most economical way to do that is to have large scale arrays of photovoltaic, let's say. And it's the same with wind, because
that means taking big, open, unused pieces of land somewhere and putting gigantic things on them.
For large scale, that's right. Of course, the thing about PV is it's low to the ground. All of the issues with wind turbines, well, most of them have to do with the fact that they're 30, 40 stories high and make a lot of noise. The PV is at least quiet. It doesn't cause bird deaths, but every technology has some impact on the environment. Doesn't matter what it is, but to produce large amounts of power, it will take large utility scale installations. And there was actually a study published in Scientific American a few years back, and the two writers estimated that if we were to provide all of the non-transportation energy for the United States, it would take an area of, I think it's 100 by 100 miles, so 10,000 square miles, with about half of it filled with photovoltaic and concentrating solar. And that would do it. Of course, we'd have to have commensurate storage so we could store that energy. But in terms of timelines,
that's not very much. Space. I mean, you take.
It actually isn't.
Southwest, you do a 10 by 10 mile square in Texas, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah.
Be distributed. That's right.
And you've got all the electricity for the United States of America.
All the non-transportation electricity was the calculation.
When we have our electric cars, we have to add a few more of those.
We have to add to that, and of course we have wind power, which. There are questions really about how sustainable wind power is because of the numbers of turbines that you need. We also have geothermal as a possibility for energy. But the challenge here is the fact that the numbers involved in large-scale renewable energy are so large in terms of equipment that we're not even fractionally there in terms of making all that equipment. So, for example, there are several studies out there that say maybe by the year 2050 we could provide maybe half of our energy from renewable energy.
So if the government were to order all the infrastructure to cover this 100 by 100 mile area,
it'd be a 40-year project probably.
You couldn't, and everybody, it would be like a war effort. Just switch all your factories to doing this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. To that and geothermal, wind power, it would be a concerted effort. Of course, for those of us who have been following energy for a long time, we're very familiar with the concept of peak oil and peak uranium and peak gas. And what this is about is the fact that at our current rate of use, and with all we can do to produce as much as possible, all of these non-renewable energy sources are going to taper off in how much we have of them, starting in
yesterday
or maybe in the next 5 years. We're essentially there, so that no matter what we do, we'll have less every year, yet our demand for energy is more every year because of rising world population and kind of a westernization of lifestyles.
Right.
So when you look at the pie, the energy pie, if we can only make so much of the pie from renewable energy, we need to shrink the pie if we're going to have enough power, you know, in the year 2000, you know, on a Monday morning in 2011.
Right.
Or 2021, whenever, we have to start doing something about consumption, too.
The problems about going along as usual really not being an option, I think, are important to discuss. For example, the long-term non-viability of both nuclear and coal for mm-hmm. electricity generation. Some people think nuclear energy is a green source. That has been refuted in so many ways.
It has. It's not only not green. And here in the Southwest, a big issue, of course, is water. Nuclear power uses a lot of water, uses more than coal.
And coal uses a lot of water.
Yeah, it's about 6/10 of a gallon per kilowatt hour for coal. So it's
now, 6/10 of a gallon per kilowatt hour, hang on 1 second. How many kilowatt hours, that's a unit of energy,
that's right,
does your household use in a month?
Well, the average for New Mexico is now 600 kilowatt hours a month. So 7,200 kilowatt hours a year. So that would be about 4,500, if I'm doing my math quick in my head, about 4,500 gallons of water.
Per household.
Per household, right, per year. And if you take, you know, tens of thousands of households, it's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water.
It's
and
a
then
lot of
nuclear
water.
Uses even more than that.
Yeah, that's right.
And so water being, as they say, the next oil in terms of declining resources, that's a factor. With nuclear, there's also the factor of a not unlimited supply of uranium.
That's right. Uranium at the present levels of use has about a 75-year amount left, basically about 75 years. If we use what are called breeder reactors, you can increase the amount, but the cost is even higher. And then thorium is another nuclear material that is about four times more plentiful than uranium, but also more expensive. The thing is that expense is part of this. That's part of the unsustainability of various kinds of energies, and nuclear is expensive.
And it also, I can't remember the name of the scientist. He was at Rice University, but he did a calculation several years ago, but within the last 10 years, that if you wanted to power the electricity grid of the entire country using nuclear, you'd have to build a new plant every other day for the next 50 years, and those plants each cost billions.
And they take 10 or 15 years to build.
And they last 40 to 60 years max.
And have to be decommissioned, a lot of expense.
And then you have a toxic waste dump.
Yeah, I think it's just not a good idea. It's not sustainable.
And then 100 years from now, which is really not that long, the people who are alive then have to start all over again.
Right. That's right. That's right.
We're talking to Daniel Jenka about renewable energy. Okay, so coal has the problem of being a fossil fuel that creates global warming. Isn't it the single greatest
it is.
Source of CO2 emissions?
Yeah, it is, and also other pollution. There's a lot of materials that are combusted and thrown into the atmosphere when coal is burnt, including radioactive materials.
Is that
so,
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's actually a dirty fuel. The so-called clean, you know, clean coal plants. The right term is cleaner coal plants, but they're by no means clean.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, clean coal is
it's cleaner.
It's a suspicious term, right?
Yeah.
And the mining of coal also has the mining of coal takes up more area of land than that mythical giant solar mm-hmm. plantation that we just talked about.
Yes, thousands of square miles.
Thousands of square miles.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've done away with, in 5 minutes of conversation, with coal and nuclear. So we're basically left with solar, wind, and geothermal if we are to sustain a population and do anything at all about global warming.
Yeah, I think so. And the other aspect too that when I give talks or do workshops, the other thing that I always like to point out to people, I mean, you can focus on the technology, you can focus on the energy payback and the financial payback and all of that, but there's also an impact on local communities. When you produce power locally or make heat locally, whether it's thermal or photovoltaic, the first thing that happens is the money you save, you spend locally. Most of us spend money locally, so it's good for local economies. When you support those industries and those companies that put in these kinds of sustainable energy systems, you're growing single-handedly. I mean, you're helping to grow the green economy, which again is good locally because that's your local green economy as well as globally, because these things are, the technologies are made everywhere. And the other thing too is that when you stop participating in this kind of endless use of fossil fuels, which come primarily from outside the United States, and for most countries come primarily outside of their own countries, well, you're having an impact on global politics and global energy use, because you're essentially saying no to something that you should say no to and yes to something that is positive. So it has all kinds of sociological, economic effects. It's like ripples that go out.
Now, one can imagine a kind of semi-distributed solar system where, I mean, I've heard the ideas of putting solar panels over every parking lot of every big box store or supermarket, and then you don't have to, take up BLM land or whatever.
Right.
And you are producing, I mean, another factor that we haven't talked about is when you produce electricity and transport it a long way, it does lose its power.
Yeah, there are line losses over long distances, and that has a big impact on the cost. But the huge impact is on the amount of coal, let's say, or natural gas that you're burning 300 miles away, and you're losing maybe half the power.
Right.
Half the energy potential is gone before you plug your coffee maker in.
So you've got all these shaded parking lots, and you're having less energy loss.
Oh yeah,
in the
absolutely.
Local community.
Yeah. Municipalities, colleges, big box stores that have big flat roofs. If they would all look at covering those roofs with photovoltaics and also solar thermal where it's applicable, like restaurants use a lot of hot water.
Right.
In terms of return, this I don't want to lose track of this. When individuals or businesses invest in solar, it's very easy to get a 7 or 8% return on investment right off the bat in the first year. So when businesses have these giant flat roofs and they're looking at their operating costs, it would be so smart for them, just from a bottom line perspective, to put money into reducing their costs and effectively getting a 7 or 8% return on investment. That's it, guaranteed.
And if they live in a coastal city, they're kind of putting in their two cents to it's not being washed away.
That's right.
When the oceans rise.
That's correct. That's right.
I just have been sort of doing the calculation in my head. You could get your 10,000 square miles just from the parking lots and rooftops, and still have a lot of open parking lots.
Yeah, distributed, you could probably get very close to that. And what we need, and it's happening, what we need to really make this happen is continued incentives for as long as they're necessary to make it a good economic return. But the other thing that I think we need is education. And I think the most fundamental thing for people to understand and to learn about, and I encourage them to go online or get books, whatever, is to just look at the fact that our fossil fuel energies are running out. And this is not a joke. So what we need to do is to throw everything we have at this problem in terms of our our science and our politics and businesses making the investment, because we need to be proactive. We really, really need to be proactive with this.
You go around the state of New Mexico giving workshops. You talk to people from really all walks of life. You talk to environmental groups, business people, homeowners, home builders, and you've been doing it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What kind of responses are you getting from people, and how has that changed over the years?
Well, people have definitely become environmentally aware because of all the attention that global warming has had, and people are more aware than they were, let's say, in the 80s, I think, about energy issues. Although in the the late 70s and 80s we had the so-called the oil crunch, which at that time was actually more or less artificial, and that actually did a lot of damage though, because people thought, oh well, that wasn't real.
Right.
But I think there is a general sense now that a lot of these issues are real. So that's a big change. But I think as a society, we're still in this mode where we are thinking quarter to quarter, businesses, and we're thinking day to day and month to month and year to year in the decisions we make. And that still hasn't changed enough, in my experience.
That basically requires that the business model, which really isn't in the hands of people, going to work and being wage earners each day.
Right.
It requires that a business model shift to a long-term sensibility. They're not going to do that without incentives. Have people talked about incentives to make them do that?
It's a thorny problem because corporations and small businesses too, they have to figure out what they're doing this month, the next month, and for the quarter and for the year. And when investors have a choice of putting their money in, business A or business B, if business A is, let's say, more progressive and is thinking longer term, they'll probably be putting more money into research and development, more money into renewables, but their short-term profits will be lower. So what we need to do, we can't blame this on businesses, I don't think. What we need to do is we need to think long-term as investors and as people who shop and buy, so that we can enable companies that are trying to do the right thing long-term, so that we go with them, even though our short-term return maybe is smaller. We may have to pay more for some products, or if we invest, we may have to settle for a lower return. That we have to join them in the long-term solution.
Right.
Otherwise, we're the problem.
Are there regulatory mechanisms coming from regulatory agencies that could aid in this? Because,
oh, sure.
I mean, market-driven things work only up to a point. If you
right.
think about people saying, gee, I think I'll buy organic spinach instead of pesticide-laced spinach.
That's right.
Most people still are buying the quote-unquote conventionally grown spinach.
It costs less. That's right.
And, in an economic crisis or even downturn or even just people trying to make ends meet, those things make a difference.
Yeah, they do. Well, of course, there are things like carbon taxes that are being looked at as a way to charge energy users who are producing a lot of greenhouse gases, to basically charge them for doing that. And the idea then is to put that money towards solutions to that problem. But I think ultimately you can only do so much with incentives and taxes, because in the end it's us.
Right.
And so somehow or other we need a cultural change. And I know one thing that has always worked in the past, and I just alluded to this earlier, but I kind of dropped it. But there's another factor that will have an impact, and that will simply be rising energy costs.
That's right. I wanted to mention that too,
yeah.
Because when you talk about your payback on a system, that's at today's prices. If prices, go up 15% every year for the next 5 years, the payback on any system that you put in is a lot greater.
That's right. So individuals or businesses, anyone who invests in renewable energy today, that's based on today's energy costs. But conservative estimates for like electric costs, is that they'll go up at least 5% a year, I think that's actually conservative. But what I was driving at is that one of the changes I've seen is that energy costs have gone up. And so every year, more and more people are interested in solar because every year, the payback gets better and better. And that's a slow kind of progress, but it's very real and it's dependable because everybody has this kind of bottom line. So
one thing that we haven't talked about is geothermal energy.
Uh-huh.
What is it and to what extent are we using it?
Well, there are two kinds of geothermal, really. One is geothermal as in deep heat, deep earth heat, of the kind where you can actually have steam coming out of the ground and drive a turbine, or where you can inject water into a deep, several mile deep hole in the ground, and steam comes out of another hole and drives a turbine. So that's deep geothermal, and that we've hardly touched here. But believe it or not, it's actually available around most of the world. It's not just at the places where the plates collide.
Right.
It can be exploited and used many places. And
the technology of that basically is drilling a hole.
Basically drilling holes and sometimes injecting water in the holes if there's not an aquifer where that heat is available.
Right.
But it's definitely a sustainable energy source and doesn't have a tremendous environmental impact except during the construction process because you're boring holes.
Right.
The other kind that you hear about all the time is what's actually a ground source heat pump, and that's where you can use shallow heat in the ground, maybe down to a few hundred feet, and believe it or not, you can extract heat from the ground using compressors and refrigerant. That's a heat pump. And so that's available as a source of heating all over the world. And you can also do cooling that way because, you know, if you dig in the ground is cool. You can actually take heat from inside of a house, and by using a compressor and some refrigerant, you can throw the heat into the ground through water in tubes. And
so
it's a great source of cooling.
You use the energy from your solar panel to power a pump.
Yeah.
That runs your refrigerant
yeah,
into
you
the ground and
the
cools
whole
your house.
Yeah, you can have everything going at once. And there's even another technology called night sky radiant cooling where you can throw heat from your house into the sky at night.
Isn't that called opening the windows?
Well, kind of. That's ventilation. This is stranger than that. Have you ever had the experience where you go out on a morning and there's ice on the roof of your car, but it wasn't freezing that night? Have you ever wondered how could it be there's ice on the roof of my car when it was only 36 degrees last night? The reason is because heat radiates all the way from here to space when there are no clouds. And you can actually throw away more heat by radiating to space so that you cool something cooler than the air around it and ice forms on it. So there are all these things we can do. I mean, there's no shortage of ideas and techniques. We can do this.
Well, it's all quite hopeful, and our hope is that the more people listen to these ideas, the more they find the courage to actually do them. I think it's scary to adopt new technology, and you don't know who to call, and you don't know how smart it is or whether you should wait, and people tend to wait.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hope they get on the ball.
Absolutely, and it's actually pretty simple. Once you look into it, the return is there, the technology is proven, so you're actually not sticking your neck out to do this.
Daniel Jenko works with Energy Concepts Corporation in Las Vegas, New Mexico, and they design and install solar and wind power systems. He also teaches renewable energy classes at Luna Community College. He gives workshops on renewable energy throughout the state. The website is energyconcepts.net, and the toll-free number is 877-765-2713. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us.
It was great being on.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.